Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Today we're going to be in conversation about a period of time between 1964 and 1972. A period of time with a great deal of social unrest in the streets, usually sparked by acts of police violence. A period that should be instructive to us today. A period of time that the government's failure to respond in a way to not just alleviate the tensions, but alleviate inequality has continued to lead to the unrest ever since. Or what my guest would call rebellions. Joining me is Elizabeth Hinton. She is Associate Professor of History and African American Studies at Yale University and Professor of Law at Yale Law School. She is the author of the book, America on Fire, The Untold History of Police Violence and Black Rebellion Since the 1960s. She joins us via Zoom. Elizabeth Hinton, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you back to this radio program.
Thank you so much, Mitch. It's great to be back.
It's great to have you back. Tell me what's significant about 1964 to 1972. This is an eight-year period. This is, I don't even know, does this period even have a name yet? And if not, should it?
I guess, you know, I mean, it kind of spans the civil rights movement, but also post-civil, the immediate aftermath and Black Power. So it could be, you know, seen as the era of civil rights and Black Power. Some people call it the long 1960s. It's part of that. But I would call it the era of rebellion, because this was the time when the nation experienced domestic bloodshed and property destruction on a scale that it hadn't seen since the Civil War. More than 2,000 cities, Black communities across the country erupted, usually in response to an encounter with a police officer, an incident of police brutality. And this, in many ways, these events defined the urban landscape and domestic policy responses to the unrest in this era.
What's happening in 1964 to spark this and sort of have these bookends be between 1964 and 1972?
Yeah. So, I mean, part of it, right, is, and let me actually go back to the Kennedy administration, because, you know, by the early 1960s, policymakers looked at the kind of demographic transformations in American society, the fact that, you know, after decades of migration of Black people from the rural South to the urban North, cities themselves had transformed, by the post-war period in the process. So D.C. was majority Black by 1960, and cities like Detroit and Cleveland were edgy majorities. Black majorities, that is. And it became clear in the given economic realities and unemployment rates that the growing Black populations in the nation's urban centers were an area of policy concern. It's what Kennedy and many of his advisors began to call in the early 60s social dynamite. They said, if there's not some kind of a federal intervention, young Black people are going to explode. And Kennedy initiated a series of federal juvenile delinquency programs in targeted cities as a way to prevent the social dynamite from exploding. And Johnson, of course, in 1964, kind of expanded many of these programs as the war on poverty, calls for the war on poverty in 64, and begins community action programs and job training and remedial education programs to address some of the social problems that were going on in the nation's cities. But the intervention had not gone far enough. And later that summer, Harlem, New York, was the first city where that social dynamite really exploded. A Black 15-year-old high school student was shot and killed by a New York City police officer, and this after kind of a host of other grievances set off several days of confrontations with police officers, property destruction, looting that spread to Brooklyn and then seven other cities over the course of that summer. And these rebellions persisted through every summer of Johnson's presidency. And between 1968 and 1972, as the war on crime that Johnson also called, and I'm sure we'll talk about that, really took off, Black communities across the nation, not just in big cities, really exploded. So this is the era of you know, these kind of two different strains of federal social policies being targeted in low-income communities of color. And that is, of course, the social welfare programs of the war on poverty and the policing programs of the war on crime. And in many ways, the persistence of rebellion reflects some of the shortcomings of those policies and the tensions that they created.
So eight cities in 1964, and it begins in Harlem. Do you think because what you have in Harlem, and then I guess you'd have another incident somewhere else, there is a connection? Like, did Harlem get a lot of attention at the time?
Harlem did get national attention because it was the first such incident that really occurred. I think that, you know, part of it is just the shared conditions of deep poverty, continued and persistent racial inequality, a kind of frustration with the lack of fundamental changes in living conditions and in access to political economic institutions, despite, you know, the civil rights movement and civil rights legislation that you know, it just created a powder keg where communities began to explode when they felt they were under attack and had no other recourse but to fight back.
So interesting when you were talking about there were warnings, and these weren't warnings that were missed. These were warnings that were actually being openly discussed about at the highest level of power in this country.
Yeah, and those warnings, I mean, that's one of the lessons of the book and in this period, those warnings persisted. I mean, the largest one came, of course, from the Kerner Commission, the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders that Johnson called during the Detroit Rebellion of 1967 to figure out, you know, why these rebellions kept on occurring. Johnson, of course, called them riots. Why these incidents kept occurring and how they could be stopped in the future. And the Kerner Commission said, okay, if we're serious about addressing the root causes of this collective violence, then we have to go well beyond the war on poverty. We have to support a major structural intervention that would mobilize the public and private sector to promote a job creation program for low-income Americans of color, a complete overhaul of dilapidated and decaying public housing, and expanded educational opportunities for low-income youth. The Kerner Commission said, if we don't, you know, absent this kind of Marshall Plan for American cities, the collective violence is only going to continue, as will white retaliation. Because, of course, the Kerner Commission famously said in its report, you know, the nation is warned in its report, the nation is moving towards two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal. And when the Kerner Commission released its recommendations, the report was sold as a mass market paperback. It became a bestseller. Johnson himself never publicly commented on it, and many of its suggestions were seen as too radical. The Johnson administration was not willing to go that far in terms of providing social welfare programs and promoting or advancing a new set of investments in the communities that had experienced rebellions. Instead, you know, the long-term solution that ended up being embraced, of course, was the expansion and the militarization of policing and ultimately mass incarceration.
Yes, Kerner Commission report is kind of like the 9/11 Commission report of its day.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
But ignored. We ended up getting a 9/11 bill. We could argue if it was good or not, but you got major piece of legislation out through after 9/11, after 9/11 a commission, but you did not with the Kerner Commission. Significant there. I was also thinking about when you were sort of outlining the changing demographics that we're seeing leading up to the 60s. It made me think this is the period after what we oftentimes consider, I guess, not one, but two great migrations. And I was also thinking about the New Deal era and redlining policies that we get in housing. I would suspect that is a part of the story.
Right, of course, because the New Deal, the redlining kind of creates, not only creates these areas of concentrated poverty, but also things like the GI Bill, That was part of the New Deal, and especially, you know, that took off in the post-war period, also promotes the out-migration of middle class and white people from cities. So that was, you know, poverty became, and black poverty became even more concentrated in part, you know, because of these longstanding policies that really entrenched inequality and segregation in the landscape of cities, but also the building of a white middle class and the building of suburban areas where, of course, which left many cities fiscally drained, right? Because they don't have they lacked the resources without that tax base to be able to fund and address these problems, to make that kind of investment that the Kerner Commission was talking about, which is why the federal government, you know, realized from the Kennedy administration that they needed to do something. And, you know, 8 years later, the Kerner Commission said, okay, you know, the federal government needs to step up even more. And we've got to really begin to pump resources into these communities, or else this violence is going to continue.
Why do you think that message was ignored?
So that's the hard question. I mean, I think consistently, political and economic elites have been really resistant to supporting the structural transformations that are necessary to meaningfully combat inequality and racial discrimination, and as they intersect in American society. I think, you know, it's difficult to build, and we see this today, right? I mean, it takes a lot to build the kind of political will and the popular support that will be necessary to, you know, fundamentally change the way that the United States governs itself. And that is, you know, leading with the principle of equality and thinking about how we might redistribute resources more equitably. This has been kind of the central question and tension within the United States, especially given our founding values. And consistently, there's been a real reluctance to bring about that kind of change and really challenge the power of white supremacy in general, in United States political institutions, but also in our culture and in our society.
Lyndon Baines Johnson is obviously an important figure in this story, and it's to me, I've seen videos of him talking about race. And in some ways, a really powerful statement that he has said about race, especially when you see these videos coming from the 60s. He's an older man, so he comes from even a previous time, a man from Texas, yet speaking in some ways, some very profound ways about race, not just about African-Americans, but about Latinos, Mexicans in particular. And yet we end up getting these policies with this war on crime and these policies that were very detrimental to people of color in this country.
Yeah, so that's one of the, you know, Nick Johnson is an enigma, in, you know, because he is the most, I mean, this is kind of like the last president that really made and I think there are people have made comparisons to Biden, and I think that there are kind of promising parallels in their rhetoric, right? But, you know, someone who seemed deeply, deeply committed to combating racial inequality, and somebody who wanted to create a great society, right? An entirely different build up specific institutions and create a different set of policies and programs. But I think, you know, just like so many other examples of liberal politicians or liberal social policies, Johnson's programs were severely limited by his own racist assumptions and blind spots and the social science theory through which he developed policy. And that is, of course, you know, deeply influenced by people like Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who recognize some of the kind of socioeconomic drivers of Black poverty, but ultimately said that Black poverty was the result of Black behavior, that it was, in Moynihan's words, a tangle of pathology that had been transmitted from one generation of Black Americans to the next since slavery. And this view, this understanding of poverty as being one of Black pathology, Black behavior, really, of course, limited the possibilities for the war on poverty and limited the scope of what a structural transformation could be, because Johnson and his advisors said, okay, well, if if black poverty isn't structural, if it's pathological, then we can fight the war on poverty relatively cheaply. And we just need to develop and implement self-help programs, as they said, for disadvantaged Americans. That was the term at the time. So instead of a job creation program, the war on poverty supported job training programs. Instead of, you know, investing in urban public schools and transforming them, the war on poverty supported remedial education programs. It had homemaker classes. It held workshops for single mothers, teaching them how to clean their homes and take care of their children. You know, many of the programs that steered it were based on or influenced by these notions of pathology. And I think these, you know, we see these racist assumptions continuing to shape and mar liberal social policy today, and they unfortunately cast a shadow over the policies of the Great Society, and also then left open the door for crime control, for the simultaneous federal law enforcement intervention that Johnson launched to end up eventually overtaking the programs of the war on poverty.
I did want to ask you about Patrick Moynihan. I think we could characterize him as one of the most influential lawmakers of the second half of the 20th century, a Democrat. This is a period of time when he's in the House of Representatives in which Democrats are in control. I mean, they had control for much of the second half of the 20th century until the rise of Newt Gingrich. He wrote the book called The Negro Family.
Right. And so this came out in March 1965, actually, shortly after Johnson had called the war on crime and just before Watts erupted in the summer of 1965. And essentially this was the theory that Moynihan put forth. He said that, you know, again, emphasizing these ideas about pathology, the tangle of pathology, and said that, you know, the key driver of black poverty is the prevalence of female headed households. And so the federal government needed to support programs that specifically targeted black men. And when Watts exploded, when Los Angeles exploded months later, that's when actually the Moynihan Report really kind of took off popularly. It was initially written just for Moynihan's colleagues within the Department of Labor, and it was kind of passed around among various agencies and officials in the White House and the executive branch. But the press began to use the ideas put forth in The Negro Family to explain why Watts had erupted, you know, basically putting forth the theory that, you know, the meaningless, senseless kids who, you know, took to the streets and looted and burned things were, you know, living in these female headed households, and their actions were, you know, latently criminal and pathological. And this became a really powerful way to explain the people who participated in rebellions. And it's actually an interpretation that my book is really attempting to push back on. The thing that's also really interesting about Moynihan is that after, you know, he gets a start in the Kennedy administration, then he's, you know, working in the Department of Labor for Johnson. And then during Nixon, he's special advisor to the president, and, you know, advises Nixon, especially on matters of race. And actually, you know, by the end of the 60s had really come to back off some of his earlier policies that call for federal policies that would directly target black men. He says, you know, actually by 1970, he says, we need a period of benign neglect where we're no longer, you know, the war on poverty failed, and we need to just not interfere at all in matters of race. And it appears as though crime is an inherent problem in black communities. It's a pathology that can best be addressed with greater police penetration. So in a lot of ways, Moynihan is kind of the intellectual backbone of both the war on poverty and war on crime programs from his perch in the executive branch. And then he goes on to serve as senator for several decades for the remainder of the 20th century. It's a pretty remarkable career.
Yeah, this is Letters on Politics, and we are in conversation with Elizabeth Hinton, Associate Professor of History and African American Studies at Yale University, and also a Professor of Law at Yale Law School. She is the author of the book, America on Fire, The Untold History of Police Violence and Black Rebellions Since the 1960s. Elizabeth Hinton, we had you on a few years ago to talk about your previous book, which was called... Of course, I see in my notes, I left out the actual title. I only have From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime, the subtitle.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah,
is that the whole title?
Well, from the War on Poverty to the War on Crime, the Making of Mass Incarceration in America.
That's it.
Yeah.
You'll forgive me. I'll have to talk to whoever makes my notes, which in public broadcasting is me. Anyways, that was a formative program for this show because it really sort of structured the way that ever since I have seen sort of this marriage, I guess, between the war on poverty and the war on crime. They were intimately connected. I remember specifically you even talking about how law enforcement would be used to implement many of these programs connected to the war on poverty.
Right. So increasingly, you know, as the rebellions persisted through the second half of the 1960s, liberals increasingly turned away from the vision of the war on poverty and embraced law enforcement and policing as a solution, at least a short-term solution, to manage the material consequences of poverty and crime and violence as they manifested through, you know, rebellion and through crime. And police officers, so whereas in the kind of early years of the war on poverty, the federal government was funding autonomous grassroots organizations directly through grant programs, by the late 1960s, 67, 68, those funds were increasingly funneled through municipal institutions, and police officers came to assume many prominent functions in the administration of these programs, so that by the end of the decade, you know, some of the cultural enrichment programs, the war on poverty that were run by social workers, morphed into recreation programs that had been that were run by police officers. So, you know, we begin to see, as the war on crime continues to take off and receives, by 1968 in the landmark Omnibus Crime Control and Safe Streets Act, which was the first major piece of federal legislation, and which begins and implements an agency within the Department of Justice called the Office of Law Enforcement Assistance to administer grant funding in a way that the Office of Economic Opportunity that steered war on poverty funding never, you know, got that kind of firm legislative implementation. So as increasingly, these social welfare programs became entangled with crime control programs. Eventually, the only way that you could get, you know, social welfare programs, job training programs, or education programs, or youth enrichment programs to low-income communities was through the crime control apparatus within the Department of Justice. And that's still, you know, in many ways the case today. Instead of just offering social welfare programs to communities that need these kinds of measures, they're funneled through crime control grants. They're framed as delinquency programs. And this is a transition that we really begin to see take hold in the 60s.
Talk to me why these eruptions that we would witness, though I, and I suspect you, were not alive during this period of time, but you oftentimes these are called riots.
Yeah.
You call them rebellions, and deliberately so. Tell me why.
So there's two reasons. I mean, one is that most of the people who participated in this form of political violence didn't see themselves as rioting. They saw themselves as revolting or rebelling. In my home state of Michigan, the events of Detroit in July 1967 are not called the Detroit Riot. They're called the Great Rebellion. And so part of it is trying to honor the ways that the people who participated in this collective violence understood their own actions. But perhaps more importantly, it's also because the term riot itself has in many ways, you know, has kept us in the cycle of police violence. And so, you know, when Harlem erupted in 64, Johnson's immediate response was, this has nothing to do with civil rights. Even though, you know, the residents of Harlem, just like every other rebellion, took to the streets for many of the same reasons that mainstream civil rights organizations and civil rights protesters did, through nonviolent channels. These, you know, the rebellions were about access to decent jobs, better housing, better living conditions, and expanded educational opportunities, the same thing that what the Kerner Commission recognized and recommended. But Johnson completely ignored that. Johnson completely ignored the root causes and the underlying demands and said, this has nothing to do with civil rights. This is criminal. It's senseless. It's meaningless. And so if this form of political protest is criminal, then the only solution is the police, right? So then we're stuck in this, where the thing that becomes the catalyst for the rebellions in the first place, the kind of most tangible expression of systemic racism that residents are rebelling against, then becomes the solution, which has kept us in this policy cycle, which is why we continue to see political violence emerge, why we saw it really, I think, in scale and frequency last summer in a way that we hadn't since the Crucible era of rebellion in the late 60s and early 70s. So, you know, what I'm trying to do is take seriously, is encourage all of us to take seriously the root causes and the reasons why people felt they had no other option but to throw a rock at a police officer, or, you know, throw a Molotov cocktail in the air and set a fire, or take goods from stores. And I think not seriously contending with these underlying issues has only exacerbated the problem. And we know now that the continued embrace of policing and surveillance has not effectively kept many of our most vulnerable communities safe, or completely prevented rebellion from continuing to be a feature of American life.
In reading what was happening in Detroit in 1967, it was remarkable to me how the scale of how big it actually was.
Right. It was at that point the largest, definitely the largest rebellion in U.S. history. I think 43 some people died. Most of the people who died were killed by National Guardsmen and police officers. It caused just completely destroyed hundreds of buildings in the city. And in many ways, you know, I mean, it took, Detroit is still recovering, just as many cities are. It was only surpassed by the Los Angeles Rebellion of 1992, which, by my assessment and many others, is the largest and most destructive act of political violence in U.S. history, causing billions of dollars in property damage and thousands of arrests.
Is this moment that we're living through right now having historians look back at 1992 and what happened after the Rodney King beating and trial?
I don't know how much we're really thinking about what we saw last summer in terms of a longer trajectory. And I think it's complicated too, because of course, you know, in many ways last summer was the convergence of two of the dominant traditions of the Black freedom struggle. I mean, you know, one of the things that's super important is that most of the protests last summer were completely nonviolent. And the kind of turn in rebellion that we see, are uprisings that we see beginning in Obama's second term, is really significant, because unlike the earlier period, unlike, you know, the late 60s and early 70s and LA in 1992, from Ferguson onward, you know, the kind of opening act was not collective violence. The uprisings began at peaceful protests and vigils, and it was only after police responded to these protests with tear gas and with batons that then some of the demonstrators fought back. So, you know, in some ways, the protests have become more peaceful, but the level of police violence has stayed the same. And I think that's one of many important distinctions between what we saw last summer and in more recent years and the earlier period. But of course, you know, the underlying, I mean, what unites them all, what unites these periods is the endurance of racial inequality and exclusion, and the continued reliance on police to, again, manage the material manifestations of that inequality. And so police officers, especially in low-income communities, are really the frontline representatives of state institutions. And certainly by the 80s and 90s, you know, as we've seen, as the continued disinvestment from social welfare programs basically leaves law enforcement and prisons as the last, you know, the social programs of the late 20th century, right? The last public institution standing. You know, police officers continue, and police incidents of police violence continue to catalyze these events that are, of course, connected to a much larger set of socioeconomic grievances, of which policing is only a part.
Are rebellions successful?
So Martin Luther King recognized by the late 60s, recognized that nonviolent or that violent political rebellion had an important role to play in the success of his own nonviolent direct action. He said that, you know, that the success of direct action protests depended on the kind of coercive power of violent protests if the nonviolent demands weren't met. So, you know, in some ways there's both of these tactics have been deeply intertwined, and even King himself, right, the King of Love, recognized that, you know, in the 60s, the violent rebellion played into some of the successes that he himself had experienced. I think last summer is another example, right? Because people had been protesting, obviously, for years. I think that we've, you know, since the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement following the murder of Trayvon Martin, but really after Michael Brown and all of these other kind of police killings that either went viral or that were discussed very much on social media, people have, you know, there's been a growing awareness about these issues that we've been blind to, that many of us have been blind to for decades, right? But it wasn't until last summer when, you know, with George Floyd and with cities literally burning again, that white Americans began to listen in a different way, and that things like systemic racism became a buzzword, that these conversations, you know, books like How to Be an Anti-Racist and the new Jim Crow shot to the bestseller list. I mean, people began to talk about race and began to talk about the future of American policing in a way that they hadn't before. So, you know, that almost reinforces and show, you know, proves King's assessment correct, that that violent protest does have a role to play, especially when nonviolent protest isn't getting its point across, isn't necessarily leading to change or new conversations. I mean, I think the ultimate question is, you know, whether or not either form of protest can and will lead to the kind of changes that that we want to see.
What was significant? This going back to the 60s and 70s is also the era of the Vietnam War, and this plays a key part in the story you tell here. Tell me why the Vietnam War is important in understanding the story around Black America domestically and also around policing.
Yeah, so there's a lot there, of course, right? I mean, I think, you know, the part of it is that the war on crime itself cannot be separated from the war in Vietnam and the tactics used against the Viet Cong, and the way that then many of those tactics get transferred to Black American and other communities of color at home. So, you know, one of the things that that the war on crime does as a riot prevention measure is begin the transfer of military grade weapons from Vietnam and U.S. interventions in Latin America and the Caribbean to urban police departments. So, you know, when Ferguson happened and we saw all those armored tanks in the streets, people were shocked that, you know, that this local police force was so heavily militarized. And the idea was that this started during the war on terror, and it definitely was facilitated as well during the war on terror, but it has its origins in the Vietnam War. And all of a sudden, you know, not just the Oakland Police Department and the LAPD and NYPD, big city police departments, but also smaller cities, rural communities were getting armored tanks and bulletproof vests and tear gas and M4 carbine rifles and M16s and riot helmets and 3-foot sticks and all of these and helicopters. All of these weapons that were being used in interventions overseas came home. And so, you know, that there's a continuum of war that this domestic war is very much a part. And then I also think too, you know, and this I have a chapter in the book on Black Sniper, that the idea of the Black Sniper kind of lurking in the shadows, waiting on a rooftop to wantonly kill police officers and white civilians really began to take hold, especially in the late 60s and early 70s, as a fear-mongering device to kind of drum up the drama of rebellion, but also of Black radicalism and protest. And I think the sniper figure in part, and we don't really, you know, that idea isn't so much part of the kind of the public enemy number one in the public imagination. And we see various forms of this, right? It was a sniper in this period in the 60s and 70s, and then it became a gang member and then a super predator. But the sniper was also deeply tied to, you know, Vietnam War tactics and the fear of Black veterans returning home from the war, being trained in military tactics, fighting for, you know, democracy abroad and being denied fundamental rights at home in a time of growing militancy when Black people are calling for self-defense. I mean, that's, you know, that's the other element that that this period of rebellion is really about, especially in the late 60s after Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination, when rebellion peaks. It's reflective of a shift in the larger civil rights movement from nonviolent protest being the guiding principle to self-defense being the guiding principle. And the idea of a sniper, you know, was the way in which the media and much of the white public kind of dealt with the politics of self-defense as they were really taking hold within Black communities as something that was, you know, Black people just shooting at police officers, when in reality, you know, during rebellions, very few police officers were harmed and killed. There were shots fired. There were, you know, figures who shot their guns in the air, but that was, you know, that was more of an intimidation tactic than it was something to, you know, basically saying, we're going to defend our community. If you're coming in here with your guns, police officers, we'll shoot back. But there were very few police casualties during this period. I mean, not matched to the number of people of color who died at the hands of police, both during moments of rebellion, but also just as a result, as we see, of everyday policing practices. So the sniper became this kind of way to explain that. And I think that idea itself is very much tied to the Vietnam War context. So it's this militarization that's accompanied by this idea of a Black sniper. And I think the fear of Black veterans that we've seen throughout U.S. history, but that takes on a different kind of significance in the context of Black power and growing radicalism and revolutionary activity at home.
Before we wrap up, I do want to ask you about how you research these stories. Again, between 1964 and 1972, I think you write that there is an intensification of these rebellions between 68 and 1972. We're talking about thousands and thousands of young people at the time who participated in this, probably thousands and thousands of people who are now I don't know, in their 70s or so.
Yep.
Many, some obviously still alive. Has there been a oral history project or something to rely on of getting at the people who participated in this?
So I was able to do some oral histories, but I think it really needs to be expanded. I mean, I think we need a larger oral history project of people who were involved in the struggle, in all kinds of struggles, right? During this period while they're still with us, because none of us are getting any younger. But I think that's something that's really important. One of the things that was so cool about this book is that the research process was so very different than my first book. My first book, you know, I knew what I was kind of looking for. I went to the archives of all the presidential administrations from Kennedy through Reagan. And for this book, I just kind of encountered this archive by happenstance. Over the course of my research from the war on poverty to the war on crime, I kept on noticing that, you know, these rebellions were popping up well into the 1970s and at a time when, you know, the conventional narrative said that this period of protests had ended. And I met Christian Davenport, who is at the University of Michigan and runs the Radical Information Project there at a friend's barbecue. And he was getting ready to do a 50-year anniversary of the commemoration of the Detroit Rebellion. This was in 2016 when we met. And I started talking to him about, you know, like, did you know that that rebellions actually, you know, really persisted into the 70s? I'd love to know more about that. And he said, I happen to have this archive that shows just that. And I said, what? And it turned out that he had in his possession the records of the Lemberg Center for the Study of Violence, which formed after John F. Kennedy Jr.'s assassination, and basically did quantitative studies and some oral histories, and perhaps most importantly, gathered newspaper clippings of all kinds of violence that was happening across the U.S. during the 60s and early 70s. So from, you know, anti-war protests to labor disputes to black rebellions. And Christian said, come on to my office, check this out. And it was box after box after box after box of all these stories. And I was just like, oh my gosh, this is a lost chapter in U.S. history that we never knew about. And there's so much more to be told in that archive. This is, you know, again, I mean, the last thing I'll say about this, and the reason why we need to document these things, why local newspaper coverage is very important, and why archives should be made public, because, you know, this archive just happened to be passed around, I think, among this kind of group of political scientists. And had this archive been made public, much of the history that I tell in America on Fire might have been told a long time ago. Somebody else, you know, would have written this. I stumbled on this archive, and once I saw this, I said, okay, you know, this history needs to be written.
You got a job to do once you saw that.
Yes, exactly. It's like, it was almost like beyond me. It was just like, okay, I'm just the vessel to tell all of these rich stories in this archive that, you know, it's really hard to assemble these little local newspaper sources. I mean, some stuff is digitized, but the Lemberg researchers did an exhaustive job of really trying to catalog everything. And of course, some sources were better than others and easier to write from. But it was an incredible resource that was literally just kind of like finding a treasure.
I mean, it makes me think with the New Deal, and we talked about some of the negative implications of the New Deal earlier, but one of the positive ones is it created a program to go interview surviving former enslaved people to make sure that they had their stories. I mean, maybe with an infrastructure bill or something, we should, you know, for an oral history project of these rebellions from 64 to 72. I do want to ask you, and you're very clear in your book, you know, this doesn't end in 1972. You talk about Miami in the 1980s, Los Angeles in the early 90s, Cincinnati in 2001. But the proliferation of these rebellions between 64 and 72, why does it die down after 1972? What happens?
Yeah, so that's a tough question. I mean, I think in part, it has to do with the rise of black political representation. So the kind of like the peak era happened when, in many cities, when black people didn't see themselves in the power structures in communities. And, you know, 1971 marks the formation of the Congressional Black Caucus, but there were thousands of elected officials at the local and state level across the country, in part due to the voting drives of the civil rights movement and that this younger generation was now of voting age. So I think that's part of it. I also think there's a dark, insidious story, and that's that, you know, one, residents became used to the policing or bitterly accepted the policing of ordinary everyday activity. That was just part of the strategies that steered the war on crime, and mass incarceration started to take off. I mean, by the mid-70s, you have the U.S. prison system coming into a black and brown majority for the first time in the nation's history. So rebellion, the stakes were higher, and many of the young people who participated in the rebellions earlier ended up getting locked up, and probably, you know, for long terms, because they had an arrest record if they participated in the earlier rebellions. So I think that's part of it. And the decade of the 1970s, you know, for many black people, especially poor black people, was a particularly devastating one. Many black families started off the 1970s doing okay. By the 1980s, by 1980, they were far worse off due to the oil crisis, deindustrialization, rising unemployment rates, you know, all of this, I think.
The drug war.
Also kind of ties in.
The drug war?
And then the drug war in the 80s, right? I mean, that's, so I think the big question, and this is the question for me moving forward, is, you know, so this collective violence emerges in the 1960s in black communities. And initially that collective violence is expressed against external forces, against police. But then in that period, sometime in the 70s and in the 80s, you know, in the context of the drug war, that collective violence goes from being externally focused to being internally focused in the form of gang warfare. And so I think this, you know, the story of rebellion and the repression of rebellion is really key to understanding the history of social harm and violence in our communities today. And really, that's one of the questions I hope to take up next.
Yeah, because we're in a real, I mean, really suggests we're in a critical moment right now, because, you know, 64, 72 doesn't stop there. We live in that shadow, especially policy shadow, ever since, which now seems to be, you know, fiercely being challenged finally after decades later. But what happens next is not guaranteed.
Right.
Or we don't know what happened next. What happens
right
next.
Yeah. But I think one thing, you know, one thing that we know and that my research aims to show is that embracing police and surveillance and incarceration as a policy solution has, you know, been one of the biggest failures in domestic programs in the history of the United States. And it hasn't effectively kept our most vulnerable communities safer. And, you know, as you say, now is the time for a different set of investments. Now is the time to bring about that structural transformation, or I fear that these inequalities and mass criminalization will only be exacerbated.
Elizabeth Hinton has been our guest. She is Associate Professor of History and African American Studies at Yale University. She is a professor of law at Yale Law School and author of the book that we've been in conversation about. It's called America on Fire, The Untold History of Police Violence and Black Rebellion Since the 1960s. Elizabeth Hinton, I've enjoyed our conversation very much, and I thank you dearly for taking this time to talk to us today.
Of course. Thanks so much for having me, Mitch.